This episode is brought to you by FX's The Veil, starring Elizabeth Moss. FX's The Veil is an international spy thriller that follows two women as they play a deadly game of truth and lies on the road from Istanbul to Paris and London. One woman has a secret, and the other has a mission to reveal it before thousands of lives are lost. FX's The Veil premieres April 30th, only on Hulu.
Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Hello, hello, everybody. It's Corey Poirier back with the latest in our interview series. This edition, we're bringing you a brand new guest who this is my first time interviewing him inside our network. So I'm always super stoked to bring on somebody new. And so, Jay, Mamie, so excited to have you here today. And Jay, where we usually start, which is a bit different, I think, than most interviews, is rather than me reading a bio that I'll probably mix up some words of and not know a name, we usually get the guests to tell us just a little bit about themselves, knowing that we're going to dive in deeper anyway, so you don't have to worry about how deep you go. But yeah, can you tell us a little bit about yourself for those that may be discovering you for the first time today?
Sure. Well, my name is Jay Mamie, and I am a radio talk show host for the Jay Mamie Talk Show here to Cumulus Media Station here in Dallas-Fort Worth, which is how you and I sort of got a chance to build our rapport, our relationship. You were a guest on the show recently. But I'm also a 10-time author. I have been in the world of finance and sales for the longest, since 1999. I got my first start as an entrepreneur when I was 13 years old. I used to live in New York City in Manhattan, a place called the Spanish Harlem. So I know in those days, if you wanted to have any of the nice things, you either became very creative in how you generated income legally or illegally. And I decided to go the legal route, and I sort of started my little entrepreneurial experience early on when I was 13 years old. And from there, I've been involved in personal training at a personal training company. I used to be an off-Broadway actor. I did some film, some theater. So I'm I was a SAG actor for a while, no longer a SAG actor. And then from there, I built my own financial services company. So I've had a financial services company for a while. I got into a ministry for a while, did some of that as well. And then for the last 15 years, there's been a lot of writing, speaking, coaching, sales psychology work, which is my background. And today I share that message with the world.
Wow. So, you know, there's a couple of directions that I would love to go from there. And, you know, I think where I'd like to start, perhaps, Jay, is just to ask you about having a radio show. You and I chatted about this sort of off air. But of course, almost everybody is going the podcast direction right now. And right. I say almost everybody. I'm not saying listeners. I'm saying more so everybody seems to have a podcast. It's like it's almost like having a license. You know, everybody you talk to is like, I got a podcast. Or, oh, you should check out my podcast. Mm-hmm. And so my question is, what made you decide to go the route of radio, first and foremost, outside of maybe going the route of switching over to podcasts or starting with podcasting?
Well, when I was in college, I had a radio talk show on campus. And then for a little while in Westchester County, I had a radio show. We're going back about 20 years ago. So I'm familiar with radio. I'm very comfortable behind the mic. And I wanted to go back to what I knew was sort of my comfort zone. Not that podcasting wouldn't be. You're right. Everyone has a podcast these days. But I wanted to go back to something that I knew that I could certainly just fall back into past experiences where it would be very simple for me to get some content on the air. And I also know the powerful aspect of radio broadcasting is very different from podcasting. Yeah, there's a much greater reach, and you can leverage the radio station's notoriety, and especially if it's a good station, part of a good group. Already with that comes the exposure and the credibility of your program, right? Whereas podcasts, you really have to build it up. The other reason I didn't want to do a podcast was, as you just said, Corey, Everyone, as they say back in New York, everyone and their mother's got a podcast. That's a New York term, by the way. Everyone and their mother, right? And it's very difficult to separate yourself when you are in that very crowded space. And unfortunately, and I speak from the hip, brother, I think that does a disservice to those who are having quality podcasts, because it becomes a diluted industry. It's watered down. And it does lose the luster of saying, I've got a podcast. And I've been on some podcasts, and I got to tell you something. Some of them, they're just thrown together. There's no preparation. The quality is terrible. I didn't want to get lumped into that.
I love it. And everything you said to me sums up radio being the answer for you, you know, like in all those areas, like the wide reach and, you know, as you said, getting the credibility. At the end of the day, I don't know, and maybe it's because there's so many podcasts, but I was going to say, I don't know why, but whenever I see the radio sort of call numbers, on the station, I look at it differently than podcasting. And I think it's partly because, as you said, everybody has a podcast. So whenever you hear somebody's on this radio station or that radio station, you know, I feel bad saying this because I have three podcasts, but I feel like it adds an extra bit of credibility. And, you know, at this time, at a time right now where maybe podcasting, because everybody has one, maybe sort of growing a little bit more, what that maybe does is it actually allows you to stand out even more so on radio, I think.
Exactly. That's exactly right. That's exactly right. And it's interesting because I do have people oftentimes now, because podcasting is that common term, and they find out that I have a show, they immediately jump to the conclusion, podcast. And even those that have been on the show as guests, when they promote the show that they're on, oftentimes I catch them saying, hey, I was a guest on Jay's podcast. And it's like, no, it's a broadcast, you know. But you're right. That's kind of the world we live in. So it does add better quality, better credibility if you have those station frequencies to say that you're part of.
Well, I'll tell you, you know, again, quite frankly, myself, whenever, so everything's about positioning, as long as you're doing it the right legal and ethical way. But, you know, whenever I started in the podcasting world, I actually started with Blog Talk Radio. And some people were like, oh, no, you got to go the iTunes route. Well, iTunes was just a new thing, but you got to go the podcasting route. And my thinking was, no, I'm going to go the route of saying I have an online radio show, because the radio had such a cachet to it. And then on top of that, after Blog Talk, my first place that I went was Stitcher, and they called it Stitcher Satellite Radio. And technically, you can get Stitcher inside your car. So and now you have to have your phone hooked up to it, which is what they don't tell you, but it can be inside your car. They call it satellite radio. So like, to me, it was actually more credibility early in those days to say I had an online radio show that was also on satellite radio. You know, like it's actually more credible. And to this, you know, to some degree, it probably still is, but that I leveraged it that way early on. And again, maybe I got caught up in the lingo as well as everybody, I guess, so do I. But one thing with mine is I did start 12 years ago. It was still in the early stages of podcasting.
Wow. Yeah.
Yeah. And to be honest, that show, you know, because in the podcasting world, there's only one website I know where you can find it, you know, how well your show is doing. And it's not even listenership numbers. It's based on just what percentage you are. So how, like, are you in the top 5% of all podcasts or what have you? Our show has been in the top 1% or less for years. And the reason is, Jay, I think is because we started so early. So we got a head start. It's like always when you're first in, like if you're, you know, what was it, Heinz Ketchup, they were first in and nobody's ever overtaken them. And apparently they were Hunt's. I didn't know this. Before Hunt's took over Pickles, they were Hunt's and nobody could overtake them until they started losing their focus and distract themselves making ketchup. And I often feel first in, you have the better chance. And so I started early. So I think that gave us a quick boost. And you get a lot of subscribers quicker. And that helped us. But it's rough because I started a second podcast 6 years ago. That podcast has done well. It's in the top 5%. But I don't think it'll ever reach the other one solely because of the fact that I started so much later. And so I think
one of the things that you mentioned, which is I was thinking about that, was you're right. There's currently 1.1 million podcasts that are out there, and every day there's brand new ones that are being registered and put out on the waves. The top 1% usually are the ones that are recognized. So the fact that you're in the top 1% is a big deal. But here's why I believe yours is in that 1% is because number one, you started early, but you've been very consistent. You've got a tremendous amount of episodes. Consistency, consistency, consistency. One of the things I see as a flaw for the podcasts that don't make it or aren't very successful, they don't have consistency. They kind of record something every now and then, and then all of a sudden they won't have anything for many, many, many months. And then they got a podcast and it's not really a quality. You've got quality, you've got consistency, and your production is strong and you promote it well. That's the reason why I noticed it's high ranking one because of those reasons. But you have to be in it for the long haul.
Well, thank
and be
you.
Consistent. Yeah.
Well, and I so appreciate that, Jay. And I'll, you know, just before we move into a different area, I'll add something to what you just said, which is the idea of that consistency. One of the other great things I think about radio is and broadcasting is you're forced to be consistent because your show won't stick around. If you have a show that airs every Wednesday at 3 and you just don't show up and you're like, missed the next 3 weeks, chances are at some point they're going to say, well, we're going to find somebody else for that spot. Like, you don't really have that choice. It's like TV back and it's still like that, but, you know, cable is different now, but in general, but, you know, cable, like if you have a show that's on Tuesday at 7, you see it all the time. When they move that show to a different night for that 1 week, the ratings sometimes drop in half. People want to know, this is when I tune in for this show. And so I think radio forces you to do that. And podcasting, it's the Wild West, so you're not forced to do it. So you just kind of do whatever you want.
Exactly, exactly.
And that's probably why I forget what I heard, like they call it the burn rate, but the rate at which people drop off podcasting. But I think it's like 9 episodes in. That's like the
end. Wow.
It's
wow.
Low. It's really low.
Yeah. I'm not surprised.
Well, another part to that too is that they're obviously, they go into it thinking I'm going to have a certain listenership. And, you know, obviously as well, when people go into that, the listenership they think they're going to have is really big. Like they're like, oh, I better have 10,000 listeners in the first 3 weeks. And when it doesn't happen, I think that also is what happens to people. They go, oh, I didn't get the big listenership I thought was just going to come because I built it. And then after 9 weeks, you know, most shows I would say in 9 weeks probably have maybe podcasts, maybe 50 listeners at most an episode. Mm-hmm. And so they're probably going, why am I doing all this work for 50 listeners? Now, I would counter that, but, you know, not enough time in the world to change every podcaster's mind. But I would counter that because podcasting is a very intimate thing. If you are consistent, if you have 100 people on your show, I always say to people, would you go down to the closest venue and speak to 100 people to share your message if they were sitting there willing to listen to it and were raving fans? Oh, absolutely. Every day of the week. You know, then why are you discounting 100 people? Because that's your listenership. So
that's
I do think also people jump off or don't promote it or don't do things properly because they're maybe embarrassed. I'm only having this many listeners, but is it only that many? If they are raving fans, what's that? What's the book? It's either 1,000. I think it's 1,000 raving fans. Mm-hmm. Well, 9 weeks in, you have 100 that are coming back every week. You're already a tenth of the way there, but most people quit by that point. So
I tell these guys when I hear them, they're getting started with the radio or blogging or whatever it is. I say, listen, don't despise humble beginnings. Mm-hmm. Don't despise humble beginnings. You've got to start somewhere. And then the greater that journey to reach those higher levels of success and listenership in this case, it just makes your testimony all the much stronger. You know, no one's inspired by an overnight fluke. And I know tons of overnight flukes. They've really literally, and you too, you know, them also overnight, they all automatically amass massive downloads. And some of that stuff is not even authentic, but it does propel them to top 1%, top 2% of listenership, but they don't have a testimony because it was manufactured, right? It wasn't really authentic. I'd rather hear from guys like you that are in it 12, 13, 14 years. I want to learn from a guy like you and not from a guy who's an overnight, success.
Yeah, it's such a great point. Like, Jay, one of the things that early on was a big thing, I was inside a couple of podcasting groups and everybody's like, oh, did you know you could do this? And it was, to your point, the shortcut. But what this was is they said, well, you can go, let's say Libsyn, one of the podcast hosts or hosting services. You can put your Libsyn feed on Twitter. And if a person listens for 1 second, just because they were scrolling and it started playing, that's considered a download or mm-hmm. listen, I should say. Mm-hmm. And so people, what they knew is they could go, okay, I'm going to schedule my tweets every 10 minutes all day for 7 days a week. And what's going to happen is, realistically, back then, I don't know even how it works now at all, but back then, we were seeing people like go from brand new show to 30,000 listens in a month.
Right, right.
The question is, how many of those people listen to more than 2 minutes? Mm-hmm. I don't know the answer to that, but that's, they right. were blowing it up. And then the worst part was those people were actually going to sponsors and saying, look, I got 30,000 listens, and also going to other people and saying, I can teach you how to launch a podcast. I got 30,000 listens. But to your point, did they have the testimony? And right. In most cases, I don't think they did.
No. And I just to finish off this point, because I know you want to bounce off to something else. You know, one of the things I learned about that very same thing, I spoke to someone who said to me about 2 years ago, they said, listen, the last thing that these really sharp sponsors who have the ability to do analytics, they know when there's authentic growth or fabricated growth. They know that. Like you said, you launch, tomorrow you got 50,000 downloads. Okay, that's not authentic. They're looking for the guy who has the 100, 200, 300 fans. These are people that are going to, that's your base. They're going to be there every week, and it's going to grow and grow. And that's what you're looking for. That's authentic.
Absolutely. Love it. And authenticity is, to me, it's the currency of the times and the future. Mm-hmm. At least for now, we go through, it's like, I think the last route we went through was personalization was the currency. You know, everybody wanted to personalize to them. I feel mm-hmm. like now authenticity is the new currency. And
absolutely.
Who knows how long it'll last, but the truth is authenticity will never go to style. I know mm-hmm. that much. Integrity will never go to style. But right now, not only are they popular to do, and are they the right thing to do, but they're, you know, they're current as well. Right. So having said that, to switch gears a bit, Jay, I wanted to talk about three areas. The first one was podcasting. Second one was writing. So mm-hmm. You have, I believe, up to 10 books out, I believe, or you're part of 10 books. And
correct.
So that's another thing you don't see often, which is because I think a lot of people, you know, get the one book out and go, okay, I'm an author now, and then don't do anything beyond. Mm-hmm. So it does take, I'm going to call it a little bit of consistency and a little bit of determination to, you know, be involved in 10 books. And mm-hmm. so I want to ask you about that process. What's that like for you? Meaning two part. I always like to ask about the writing and then the marketing, but on the writing side, everybody always asks me, how do you write and what's your approach to writing? And I know different people have different styles. Like some people plan before they write. Some people write every day at this time. Some people just randomly say, okay, I'm feeling that I only write when I have the muse. I'm feeling it right now. I'm going to sit mm-hmm. down. So mm-hmm. I'd love to hear, do you have a certain writing style or approach?
You know, it's funny. Let's start with what you were pointing to early on in this particular question. Then I'll get to the writing style. The one thing I've learned early on is everyone, and I didn't believe this in the beginning. I didn't believe it. But when I had heard 13, 14 years ago, when I was questioning, why should I write anything? Who's going to read my stuff, right? Because every writer goes through that. Mm-hmm. Every writer goes through that. I was encouraged by a guy who had written a couple of books. He said to me, look, for every ear, there's a story to hear. Mm-hmm. For every ear, there's a story to hear, meaning don't worry about bestsellers, million-dollar copies sold. Your book, your story may only impact a handful of people. And if you're writing to impact, not to profit, then it doesn't matter if it's 10, 30, 100, or 1,000 or a million, right? Somebody's going to be impacted by your story. For every ear, there's a story to hear. I was like, wow. That's what motivated me to really get out there and start writing my first book, which was a men's devotional. It was actually called A Common Man's Devotional at the time. I was a men's ministry director. And I realized, you know what? Let me write something that was really written for me, which is the first style of writing. I think you have to write something that you not only believe in, but as you're writing it, it's therapeutic. The best written, and when I'm talking about, you know, nonfiction stuff, right? The stuff that's not, you know. It's got to be something that as you're writing it, it's therapy. It's filling your soul. It's feeding your soul. That if nobody else reads it, you're like, man, that helped me. Right? Absolutely. So when I wrote that book actually was titled A Common Man, because I thought, I'm a common guy. What do I? Who's going to read my stuff? But it resonated with a lot of other men because I related on their level. And then from there, I wrote the Entrepreneur's Devotional because I felt that there are some biblical principles that an entrepreneur could apply to success. I wrote that book again, but I'm writing it for me. So essentially, a lot of the books I've written, which go through my writing style, I write books as if I were the only one that's going to read them. If I was writing it to myself as the reader, but then I incorporate my experiences, my knowledge, things that I've gone through, lessons I've learned, and things that I know that other people are lacking, where they could use encouragement, empowerment, instruction, inspiration, teaching on. So I kind of blend it all together in a way that it'll give somebody some actionable stuff to walk away with after they read it. You know, none of my books are fluff. It's in your face kind of writing. And I think people appreciate that. I also, the writing style is not where it is loaded with pages and pages and pages of stuff, because I don't read books that are pages and pages and pages of stuff. If the book has over 70 or 80 pages, I'm probably not even going to buy it. Right? If it's 70 or 80, in fact, I've got books on my desk. If I have more time, I'll show you. If it's a book that I can read within a day or two in a few hours, as busy as I am, I'll tend to read that book. So I want to write for that reader who's in the same place. But they could knock it out and say, man, I could read this again. If you write a book that someone, once they get through with, they're like, I'm not reading that again, then not that it's not a good book, but they put it down once, how much of an impact did it make? But if they want to reread it because it's brief and it's impacting, that one has stickability. And that's a book they're more likely to share than that 400 page novel that once they read it, man, that thing is gone. Okay. So that's my writing style.
No, and I totally appreciate that. And you're right. I tend to read, I'm looking around here at different books I have, but I tend to read smaller books, like you say, more frequently. And I do reread some books, but the only books I reread that are really, I'm going to call it thicker books, are like, you know, to me, they're like the books that I can read a section or a chapter and leave and come back 4 months later and I don't feel like I lost anything. So example is Think and Grow Rich. I reread it almost every year. How to Win Friends and Influence People by Dale Carnegie. I read it quite regularly. Those are two somewhat big books. A book I have near me right now is Jeff Walker's Launch Book. It's a fair-sized book. It'll take me a while to read it, but I already read his previous one was a paperback and it was smaller. So I read the same book and he just updated it. So what I'm doing is I'm skipping parts that I already know and going to the newly added parts. And so again, I mean, I find it tough to read it in one, you know, one round. Like I take pieces and it might take me a while to read it. But then I got System Idea, Four Agreements, which is a smaller book. And I'll reread this one probably, you know, three times a year because it's so small. Like, those people can see it here. It's not even as small as you're talking about, but it's like 140 pages. It's still a fairly small book.
So
I'm the same as you. And so I appreciate that writing. And it is a style, I think. And, you know, to that point as well, I feel like something you said here with the consistency is people ask me, you know, when it comes to books, what should I do here? What should I do there? And I always say to people, the first thing is write a good book. You know, I see so many people now with the event of, let's say, Create Space or Amazon, where you can pump a book at, people even promote it. Like, you can have your book in 24 hours from not even being written yet. I'd love to see the book that's written and released in 24 hours. In fact, I'd love to see it the outside, but I'm not going to read it. And what I'm getting at there, Jay, is that I still think you should have a quality product. Now, I believe you can have a quality book written in 30 days, but I don't think that, you know, if you write a book, no editing, no looking at it again, just like type and go and press print. I think it's going to be, as you said, it's going to be harder to have people pass that book along or tell other people, because they might be hung up on the fact that, Christ, I can hardly read this because the word "the" is three times in a row in spots. And so I really think that you should make a good, it's like anything. If you want to have clients to come back, you can create something that's viral, but not if people return because it's not a good quality. But I think if you have who says it? Seth Godin. You know, he talks about having a remarkable product. If you have a remarkable product, people will tell other people and people will return.
Right.
And so I think the book should be remarkable first and then focus on everything else. So I love that you are taking into account, what's a book I'd like to read? Part of that means it's a short book. And what's a book I would read more than once? Like, I love that you have a strategy behind why you're writing a short book.
You know, one of the things, and one of the things you mentioned, and I'm glad we're having this conversation, because I think there are a lot of people that want to write. They've got this unction. They just know that they've got a story within inside of them to share, but they don't have a writing style. Their grammar isn't the best, right? But there's a message there. So I encourage that person, just like I encourage people that I sometimes coach when they're writing their first book, get somebody to help you write the book. It's okay. Like my brother is a perfect example. He's got a great story. He's got about a real estate story. He's one of the top guys in New York. He's got great content, but he's not really a writer. So that's what's holding him back. So I said to him, partner up with a writer who can bring your message, your thoughts to life in a, you know, properly written book with grammar and great connotations. Don't let yourself get held back because of that. There's plenty of people that will help you write the book, not ghost write the book, but they will help you write the book. In other words, putting your thoughts into their words. So, and I think a lot of people, they see that as being an authentic writing, but it really is. Just because you get somebody to write the words, they're writing your thoughts. It's a collaboration.
Yeah, it's a great point. There's two books that I would say changed. Well, both I would say have changed. Well, one for sure changed millions of lives, perhaps. The other one is close to a million, if not millions. But two books I can think of where the writers got other people to help them write it. And those two authors are certainly not looked down upon because they had somebody help them write it. One is Robert Kiyosaki with Rich Dad Poor Dad.
Right.
So he said, I'm not a best-selling writer. I'm a best-selling author. And he said, if you see my first drafts of the book, you would not buy the book. And but what I took from that when he said it is he wrote the first draft. He still did some writing, but he had Sharon Lecter, who helped him write almost all of those books. And she's a prolific writer. Mm-hmm. And the two of them together partnered. That book series has sold 26 million copies now.
Wow. You know,
and so imagine if he said, I'm not a writer. And so I agree with you totally. And then the other person I was thinking of was Bob Berg, who has The Go-Giver, which is, I feel like it sold over a million copies. But that book was co-written. I just lost his name, but it's a guy who co-writes. He does do ghostwriting, but he co-writes a lot of big books. He co-wrote The Slight Edge, that book, which was a huge seller. And Bob and him have written like 8 books together. But he's co-written every book with Bob around the Go-Giver type series. And so, again, they're writing together. They're sitting in a room writing together. They're tossing ideas around. But I respect the fact that Bob is saying, you know what, this makes our partnership makes this book better. Now, I don't know this, but Bob might be able to write the book himself, but he recognizes there's a power in having a co-writer with him. And with Robert Kiyosaki, he said he needed somebody to help him kind of pretty up the book. Mm-hmm. But to the point about like your brother, I think if somebody has an amazing story in them, however they get the story out, it needs to get out because it's going to impact lives.
That's exactly right. That's exactly right. And I think the worst thing that a person can feel at the end of the day is regret that they didn't do it. You know, in the end, if you step out in faith and you've got the courage to get it done and you get it done and it doesn't, it's not the quality or it doesn't do much, at least you could walk away saying, I gave it a shot. Hmm. Yeah. Maybe no one really was interested in my story because it wasn't that exciting. Or my lessons and my teachings or whatever it is I'm going to talk about, but I don't have regret that I didn't do it. I gave it a shot, and that's 95% of what most people never do. They never give it a shot. So sometimes the sense of accomplishment, even if it's not successful accomplishment, sure beats the hell out of regret.
Yeah, just to validate what you just said, Jay, and then I want to ask one more thing about the book side, but just to validate what you just said, I've done, you know, a lot of people know this. I'm obsessed with interviews. So I've done thousands. I mean, we're over 6,000 now, which is insane to think about. Yeah. And whenever I think about that, I often think about what are the common traits. And one of the things I've discovered is more people struggle with regret than failure. Like, in other words, people have a bigger challenge with something they wish they would have done that at the time they thought, oh, I can't do that, and just didn't do it. They regret that more than the thing they did and failed on. And I believe, I don't know the percentages, but I believe based on what I've studied and the interviews I've done, that regret may be even as many as 2 times greater than dealing with failure. And so to your point, I think to regret not having your story out in the world, I mean, to me, that would be the saddest thing. And by the way, listen, I'm not saying I'm above that because I was going to write my first book 10 years before I did. And what got me going was I actually wrote in a compilation book. And by being in a compilation book, I was able to only contribute a chapter, but able to see my book in print and be in an Amazon and become a best-selling author and all those things. And I was like, oh my gosh, we did it. This isn't as hard as I've been making it. And that's what kicked me in the butt. But I would have been that person, perhaps, if I never had that happen, that maybe today still wouldn't have a book out and still regret that I never did it. So your point, I think, yeah, even if it doesn't, there's no shame in co-writing with somebody else. Not everybody's meant to be a writer.
No, and you know, and one, we could talk about this for hours, but one last point, which is really, really critical, is, and this is what I share with those that I'm coaching and encouraging them to write your first book, is it's a legacy piece. It's a legacy piece. Because that's the kind of book that your great, 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 great grandkids, your grandkids, one day they'll say, you know, that guy there, that's my great, great, he didn't sell but two copies and he sold one to grandma, but he wrote that book. And so generations to come, your kids, your generational grandkids will have a chance to hear and understand what made grandpa tick, what made you tick. It's a legacy piece. Right. I've got 10 legacy pieces to leave behind to my kids and my kids' kids and on and on and on. And that is satisfying.
I love that you added that, because we have a compilation series called Blue Talks. And when people say to me, what are the benefits of being in a book? That's one of the things I always say is, you know, this is something that your great, great grandchildren won't be like. And, you know, my grandfather, he raised me like he was basically my more than my second father. And I'm an only child. My mother's an only child. So when I lost my grandfather, it was a big deal. And my grandfather was a great storyteller, but he never told me all the stories. And, you know, and so I often think if I would have written, even because he was grade three education, but if I would have written a book with him telling me the stories, that would have been invaluable to me. It would have been priceless. Right. And so I tell people, don't let that go by you. You know what? It doesn't matter if you're in our book, but however you get that, your story out, get it out, because otherwise, how do your great grandchildren know your story?
It's exactly right.
Later on in life, those are the things that are worth more than the money. So I love that you added that. And then I said I want to ask one more thing about books, and I'll just ask it really quickly, and you can go in as depth as you want to, Jay. But when it comes to the books that you put out, are there any people in our community are always looking for strategy? But are there any marketing strategies or things that you tried that you said, whoa, that moved the needle more than I thought, or anything you can share on the marketing side that you do that may be a bit unique from what others do?
Yeah, I think you have to leverage, even there's a lot of ways to leverage online, but I think one of the things I've done that I've learned it later on, and I'm going to go back and do it with some of my early books, I'm going to re-release with revisions and additions and things like that. But LinkedIn events, if you're on LinkedIn, you can host a LinkedIn event that talks a little bit about something that is in your book, okay? Just like a little teaser trailer, maybe a 15-minute, 20-minute talk about a particular topic. I did that for my book, 7 Powerful Techniques for Subconscious Communication. I actually did a LinkedIn webinar with that. The other thing you could also do is little video clips of something in your book, and you can blast that on Instagram, you know, little video story on Facebook, little video story. So they just kind of just whets the appetite of whoever is online, whoever's following you, whatever's going on with your social media platforms. But it gives them a little taste. It's just a little taste, a little taste, a little taste. And of course, getting on podcasts as well gives you a chance to share that message on someone else's platform. But even, for example, on my show, on the radio show, one of the things that I do 2-3 times a month is I highlight brand new authors. So if you've got your bestseller, or you're not, it's not the platform for you. It's the platform for someone that says, I just got a book out. I want people to immediately hear my story and my book. So if there's an opportunity to get on a radio show to talk about your book, you have to take all the options that are available to you. And by the way, let me just say this. Do not be afraid to invest in yourself with marketing dollars. Now, it's amazing, Corey, and I'm sure you're familiar with, you've spoken with so many folks over the course of your career, how there are people, they want a champagne life, but they've got Ripple budget. They've got a beer budget, right? Ripple, the old Sanford and Son Ripple. Yeah, you can't do that. If you're going to be successful, you have to understand it's going to take the investment of your time and energy and money. Mm-hmm. If you forget the money part, time and energy is only going to take you so far. You need money to invest in the marketing and this and that and the other. And I'm amazed at so many people that call themselves entrepreneurs and business owners and success seekers, but they're very stingy when it comes to investing in their own success marketing wise. Not millions of dollars, but a few hundred dollars is not a whole lot to ask if it's going to give you exposure where your book or your product can be highlighted. So you have to kind of do those things, I believe, if you're going to have success in anything, but especially showcasing a brand new book.
I love it. And you've given me a good segue to my last part. I want to ask, we've got about 5 minutes left and I want to ask you about speaking, but you gave me a good segue. I'm not sure if you're familiar with the speaker, Eric Thomas.
Yes. You know, yeah. I know Eric Thomas. Yeah.
So Eric
the Thomas. The hip hop preacher.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And one of the things that he said that I love, and it's not exactly what you're talking about in the sense that he wasn't talking about money, but it's the same type of thing, which is with the champagne lifestyle. I love how he says, you want my lifestyle, but you don't want my grind.
Mm-hmm.
And he talks about how people are like, oh, Eric, I'd love to have your life traveling on planes and this and that. But he said, you don't want to. And not that you have to like do the Gary Vee hustle thing all the time, but basically he's saying you're not willing to get up at 5 a.m. to travel to the speaking engagement, but you want the lifestyle that I have because I'm willing to do that. Mm-hmm. And I think it's the same type of thing. Like you have to put it in, whether it's, like you said, the time or the money or the hustle or whatever it is, but you can't expect the rewards of somebody else if you're not willing to put in what they put in.
Exactly. I mean, it's delusional. There is a blog and a video that I've put out there called Eat, and I have fun with it. I'm the self-titled number one in the world actiontainer. So I'm an entertainer that's going to entertain you so that you can take action. Actiontainer, the number one in the world, because there's nobody else. If there's nobody else, you're number one.
Right? Love it.
So one of the things I talk about is, in a fun way, I said, don't fall prey to the EDD disease. Now, when guys are in the audience, they know what EDD stands for, right? But I call it not that EDD. I call it EDD because it's entrepreneurial delusion disorder.
Wow. I love that.
Entrepreneurial delusion disorder, where you think that you're going to arrive, like Eric Thomas says, is some high level of success, but you're not willing to do the work, you're delusional. It's a disorder.
You're in good company because you made, when you said the world's number one, it makes me think of, and this will dive me into the speaking side, but it makes me think of Larry Winget. I don't know if you're familiar with him as well, but he's the guy that has the books like, you're broken, it's your own fault, and I can prove it. Like, very politically incorrect books back in, like, today they would be. Like, he had 11 New York Times bestsellers with names like that. And today I feel like somebody would be, I hate to say it, but somebody would be trying to cancel him. But
yeah.
He did it. So he actually called himself the world's first irritational speaker.
Oh, wow. That's awesome.
And it's not. Like, he would go on, he was on Oprah and Larry King Live multiple times, and that's what they called him. We want to bring out our next guest. He's the world's first. Like, it stuck. It was really brilliant. But again, he was the only one. So he could say he was the first, and then also if he wanted, he could have said he's the number one. And even if 10 other people eventually called himself that, he would have still been the number one because he started long before and had a big head start. But anyway, just good segue to ask you the last part, which is about speaking. I'd love to hear, I'm really curious for speakers because of the pandemic, because of COVID, how that affected them and how they've maybe pivoted or what they've done to pivot or if they pivoted, because some people might have just said, I'm putting the speaking on hold for a while. But I'd love to hear how COVID or the pandemic has affected you in terms of your speaking. And then B, I just want to ask you a question or two about speaking. But first and foremost, what has it done to your speaking?
You know, the minute the pandemic hit, just like every other speaker, a lot of bookings I had completely on ice. And some of those bookings, they've either canceled or they've gone to a virtual platform. That's difficult for me. I'm very effective, whether it's virtual or live, but I'm very animated. So for me, and I bring a lot of energy, it's very difficult to transcend that virtually, right? You can do the best you can. So there's some teachers and speakers that virtually, they're it doesn't matter, right? But for me, it's different. So for me, it hurt me because people need to experience me there. So obviously some of those things were canceled or some of them have gone virtual. So my virtual speaking has gone up, but the result from it have not been what they could have been had they been in person.
Right.
Okay. Because I'm a guy that I want people to walk away thinking to themselves, that guy's memorable. And you only do that when it's in physical form. Right. So yeah, my speaking gigs have not been hurt to the extent of less than. They've pivoted to something virtual, but the result of what I'm looking for has not been what I know I could have received had it been live.
And you're certainly not alone, Jay. Like I've asked this question to quite a few speakers, and I've had a lot of them say to me similar, you know, that they didn't have the results they wanted because they like being live, to the point where some people saying, I'm not even doing them, like virtual. I'm only doing live. But the only exceptions I've heard to that really is somebody like a Les Brown. You know, so Les was telling us that his bookings have been about the same, but he can do more bookings now because he doesn't have to leave his computer. But the thing with Les, like, we've had him on for interviews, and even just his laugh, people are like, I tune in and listen to that guy's laugh. He's got whatever that is. But even Les, I mean, this little box can't capture all of what he is. If he's live, it's another level. But even somebody that has that next level, I think still with the virtual, he's as doing almost as good as you could do, where, you know, the bookings are almost the same amount. He's still getting booked like crazy. But I think for him, it's more that he doesn't want to get on a plane anymore. So he's
absolutely.
I'll make this work. But he's the exception. Like, most of the speakers I'm talking to either A, don't like virtual as much, but they're still doing it, or B, are just saying, I'm just waiting for live to come back around. It's interesting for me to see that, because I thought I was going to hear all these people say, I'm so glad we have virtual now and live is done. And, you know, I thought that I would hear a lot of that. And to be honest, I haven't.
No, I did a talk last week, two Fridays from this past, from tomorrow. And it was interesting. Toastmasters, which you've heard of Toastmasters, right?
Absolutely.
I'm not a Toastmaster member, but I was asked to speak to be one of their Friday night keynote speaker in the Dallas convention. And they had the following night, the actual 2020 Toastmaster world champion speaker. So I was like, wow, I'm speaking alongside that guy. He's the world champion. They went outside of their own to bring me in. And the point I'm making is everybody was so happy that there was a live, it was their first live event from 2 years ago. And everybody was so happy. So the message was received much better by the attendees themselves, let alone us as the speakers. The attendees loved the fact that it was live. So I think from their perspective, they're looking for something that's a live experience as well. People are tired of Zoom, I think.
Yeah, I'm the same thing. Like, I just to put it in perspective, last night we had a Zoom call for one of our groups, and it's more just like, I'm trying to get everybody more engaged and getting to know each other and networking and stuff. So we did our first Zoom call for our Blue Talks community. And I think, and I'm going by memory on this, and because I only looked at the bottom a couple times, but I think we had about 35 people there. Which I was pretty happy with, because we mentioned we were going to do it, and then we didn't, on my own fault, we didn't say anything about it really until the day before and said, oh, by the way, it's tomorrow night. So, of course, you have some people that are like, they said they were in, but then didn't put it in their calendar, and now they couldn't make it. But the point I was going to make with it is, I loved it, and it's the best we can do without being able to be there live, but it's such a different feeling. Like me, because I was hosting it essentially. And to get that feedback that you would normally get if you're there live, it's just a totally different thing. Like, you're trying to look on the screen and see reactions and, you know, somebody, do we have any questions? And two or three people are trying to talk, and you have to try to, whereas if it was the audience, you know, and of course they can put their hand up, but if it's the audience and they put their hand up, you pretty much are looking around, you can see who it is. But when you're on a screen with 30 people and you're looking and it's like five per thing, so it's six rows, you're trying to keep up with all that. It's hard to get that same feel.
And you lose your flow. You lose your flow. You know,
absolutely. Yeah. Well, I seen Tony Robbins had this. I don't know if you saw it, but when he did his last virtual event, it was like he had all these massive screens in front of him, like floor to ceiling screens and that. And so he had, I forget the number, it was like 17,000 people or something. And I'd be curious to know if it felt the same for him, because I can't imagine. Like, I think he'd normally have 5,000 people at the live event versus maybe 17,000 more people, but it's all little dots on a screen.
Right.
I'd be interested to know if he found it the same way. Like, if, in other words, if he goes, oh, this is so much easier now, I can bring more people, we don't have to travel, or if he's going, oh, I miss that energy. And I'm guessing a guy like him is missing the energy.
Oh, absolutely. He'd rather take 5,000 in a cocoon environment that's energetic than 17,000 where people can just easily, you know, hit that not share screen button and, you know, go to the bathroom or and you actually, you notice that's the thing that's distracting from Zoom. You notice sometimes when people log off because their screen goes dark or they put their picture up. The live version, I would suspect that he would certainly appreciate more.
Absolutely. Well, and like I said, I just like to ask everybody their experience with it. So, Jay, you've been an absolute pleasure. I'll call it to be continued. We went a bit longer than I usually do, and I'm still thinking we didn't even scratch the surface. But I think we gave people a great taste of who you are. And so, with your permission, I'll call it to be continued. But I also, Before we let you run, I want to ask you maybe the most important question, which is, no matter how long the conversation is, there's always going to be people that want to connect further, want to jump on social media, follow you, but, you know, want to know about the books that we talked about. So is there a hub or a place where you'd normally send people?
They can go right to my site, djmaney.com. There, djaymaymi. They can go from there to my book site. They can find my books. They can find my merchandise. I've got some pretty cool merchandise in my own online store called Thriveology. It's some cool stuff in there. From there, they can link right to the jmaneytalkshow.com. So that's the central hub. And from there, they'll find where they want to go.
I love it. And I love that you had one spot. Every now and then I'll say two when I know I shouldn't. But I love that you have one spot because I find with all of us, we're so busy now that if you say, go to this website for this, go here for this, go here for that, most people will probably just freeze and not do anything. So hub, I think, is always the easiest route. So I'm glad you did that. So, Jay, this has been an absolute pleasure, as I mentioned. Again, to be continued, my friend, and thank you for crushing it here. And this is, this is just starting because this will make its way out to, you know, some people are listening to me right now on the podcast. Some are listening here. Some are listening on our platforms like Apple TV and stuff. So This will have a good long shelf life, Jay. So I thank you for bringing stuff that was timeless to make that possible.
Well, I appreciate the invitation. Thank you.
Thank you, my friend. Thanks, everybody, for joining us. And I have another interview coming up later today with Chandler Bolt talking about books heavily. So join us then, but I'll send more details inside the group. Thanks, everyone. Thanks again, Jay.
This podcast is a part of the C-Suite Radio Network. For more top business podcasts, visit c-suiteradio.com.